wind or current brought. In the beginning he had seen no value in these odds and ends, but Lonio found a use for nearly all. A cartwheel was turned into a spinning wheel, parts of the horse bridle made belts for the children, a saddlebag became a pair of boots, and Taran shortly realized there was little the family needed that did not, late or soon, appear from nowhere. And there was nothing, an egg, a mushroom, a handful of feathers, delicate as ferns, that was not held to be a treasure. In a way, Taran told Gergi, Lonio's richer than Lord Gast is, or ever will be. Not only that, he's the luckiest man in Prydain. I envy no man's riches, Taran added. Then he sighed and shook his head. But I wish I had Lonio's luck. When he repeated this to Lonio, the man only grinned and winked at him. Luck, wanderer? One day, if you're lucky, I'll tell you the secret of it. Beyond that, Lonio would say no more. At this time, a thought had begun taking shape in Taran's mind. Nearly all of Lonio's finds had been put to one use or another, save the flat stone which still lay in the shed. But I wonder, he told Lonio, I wonder if it couldn't serve to grind meal better than the quern. How then? Cried Lonio, greatly pleased. If you think it can, do as you see fit. Still pondering his idea, Taran roamed the woods until he came upon another stone of much the same size as the first. That's a stroke of luck, he laughed as Lonio helped him drag it back. Lonio grinned. So it is, so it is. During the several days following, Taran, with Gergi's eager help, toiled unceasingly. In a corner of the shed he set one stone firmly in the ground, and the other above it. In this he laboriously hollowed out a hole, and, using the leftover harness leathers, in it he affixed a long pole that reached up through an opening in the roof. At the top of the pole he attached frames of wood, over which he stretched large squares of cloth.
But this is no quern, Gergi cried when at last it was done. It is a ship for boatings and floatings, but there is no ship, only mast with sails.
We shall see, Taran answered, calling Lonio to judge his handiwork. For a moment the family stood puzzled at Taran's peculiar structure. Then, as the wind stirred, the roughly fashioned sails caught the current of the breeze. The mast-like pole shuddered and creaked, and for a breathless instant Taran feared all his work would come tumbling about his ears. But it held fast, the sails bellied out and began turning, slowly at first, then faster and faster, while below, in the shed, the upper stone whirled merrily. Gerwin hastened to throw grain into Taran's makeshift mill. In no time, out poured meal finer than any the quern had ground. The children clapped their hands and shouted gleefully. Gergi yelped in astonishment, and Lonio laughed until the tears ran down his cheeks.
Wanderer, he cried, you've made much from little, and done it better than ever I could.
Over the next few days, the mill not only ground the family's grain, Taran also struck on a means of using it as a sharpening stone for Lonio's tools. Looking at his handiwork, Taran felt a stirring of pride for the first time since leaving Craddock's Valley. But with it came a vague restiveness. By rights, he told Gergi, I should be more than happy to dwell here all my life. I found peace and friendship, and a kind of hope as well. It's eased my heart like balm on a wound. He hesitated. Yet somehow Lonio's way is not mine. A spur drives me to seek more than what small Averin brings. What I seek I do not know, but alas, I know it is not here. He spoke then with Lonio, and regretfully told him he must take up his journeying again. This time, sensing Taran's decision firmly made, Lonio did not urge him to stay, and they bade each other farewell. And yet, Taran said, as he swung astride Melinlass, alas, you never told me the secret of your luck.
Secret? Replied Lonio. Have you not already guessed? Why, my luck's no greater than yours or any man's. You need only sharpen your eyes to see your luck when it comes, and sharpen your wits to use what falls into your hands.
Taran gave Melinlass rein, and with Gergi at his side, rode slowly from the banks of Small Averin. As he turned to wave a last farewell, he heard Lonio calling after him.
Trust your luck, Taran Wanderer, but don't forget to put out your nets.
Chapter 18. The Free Comets. From small Averin they wended eastward at an easy pace, halting as it pleased them, sleeping on the turf, or sheltering at one of the many farmsteads among the rich green vales. This was the land of the Free Comets, of cottages clustering in loose circles, rimmed by cultivated fields and pastures. Taran found the Comet folk courteous and hospitable. Though he named himself only as Taran Wanderer, the dwellers in these hamlets and villages respected his privacy and asked nothing of his birthplace, rank, or destination. Taran and Gergi had ridden into the outskirts of Comet Senarth when Taran reined up Melinlas at a long, low-roofed shed from which rang the sound of hammer on anvil. Within, he found the smith, a barrel-chested, leather-aproned man with a stubbly black beard and a great shock of black hair, bristly as a brush. His eyelashes were scorched, grime and soot smudged his face. Sparks rained on his bare shoulders, but he seemed to count them no more than fireflies. In a voice like stones rattling on a bronze shield, he roared out a song in time with his hammer strokes, so loudly that Taran judged the man's lungs as leathery as his bellows. While Gergi cautiously drew back from the shower of sparks, Taran called a greeting, scarcely able to make himself heard above the din. "Master Smith," he said, bowing deeply as the man at last caught sight of him and put down the hammer. "I am called Taran Wanderer, and journey seeking a craft to help me earn my bread. I know a little of your art, and ask you to teach me more. I have no gold or silver to pay you, but name any task, and I will do it gladly."
"Away with you,"
shouted the smith.
"Tasks I have a plenty, but no time for teaching others to do them."
"Is time what lacks?" Taran said, glancing shrewdly at the smith. "I've heard it said that a man must be a true master of his craft if he would teach it."
"Hold!"
roared the smith as Taran was about to turn away, and he snatched up the hammer as if he meant to throw it at Taran's head.
"You doubt my skill? I flatten men on my anvil for less. Skill? In all the Free Comets none has greater than Hevid, son of Hewas."
With that he seized the tongs, drew a bar of red-hot iron from the roaring furnace, flung it on the anvil, and set to hammering with such quick strokes that Taran could hardly follow the movements of Hevid's muscular arm. And suddenly there formed at the end of the bar a hawthorn blossom, perfect in every turn of leaf and petal. Taran looked at it in astonishment and admiration. "Never have I seen work so deftly done."
"Nor will you see it elsewhere,"
Hevid answered, at pains to hide a proud grin.
"But what tale do you tell me? You know the shaping of metal. The secrets are not given to many. Even I have not gained them all."
Angrily, he shook his bristly head.
"The deepest? They lie hidden in Inúvin, stolen by Arrón, Death Lord. Lost they are, lost forever to Prydain. But here, take these,"
ordered the smith, pressing the tongs and hammer into Taran's hands.
"Beat the bar smooth as it was, and quickly before it cools. Show me what strength you have in those chicken wings of yours."
Taran strode to the anvil, and, as Karl had taught him long ago, did his best to straighten the rapidly cooling iron. The smith, folding his huge arms, eyed him critically for a time, then burst into loud laughter.
"Enough! Enough!" cried Hevid. "You speak truth. Of the art, indeed, you know little.
And yet," he added, rubbing his chin with a battered thumb nearly as thick as a fist,
"and yet you have the sense of it."
He looked closely at Taran.
"But have you courage to stand up to fire? To fight hot iron with only hammer and tongs?"
"Teach me the craft," Taran replied. "You'll have no need to teach me courage."
"Boldly said,"
cried Hevid, clapping Taran on the shoulder.
"I'll temper you well in my forge. Prove yourself to me, and I'll vow to make a smith of you. Now, to begin."
His eye fell on Taran's empty scabbard.
"Once it would seem you bore a blade."
"Once I did," Taran answered, "but it is long gone, and now I journey weaponless."
"Then you shall make a sword," commanded Hevid. "And when you've done, you'll tell me which is harder labor, smiting or smithing."
To this Taran learned the answer soon enough. The next several days were the most toilsome he had ever spent. He thought at first the smith would set him to work shaping one of the many bars already in the forge. But Hevid had no such intention.
What? Start when half the work is done?
Hevid snorted.
No, no, my lad. You'll forge a sword from beginning to end.
Thus, the first task Hevid gave Taran was gathering fuel for the furnace, and from dawn to dusk, Taran stoked the fire until he saw the forge as a roaring, flame-tongued monster that could never eat its fill. Even then, the work had only begun, for Hevid soon put him to shoveling in a very mountain of stones, then smelting out the metal they bore. By the time the bar itself was cast, Taran's face and arms were scorched and blackened, and his hands were covered with more blisters than skin. His back ached. His ears rang with all the clank and clatter, and with Hevid's voice shouting orders and instructions. Gurgi, who had offered to pump the bellows, never faltered, even when a cloud of sparks burst and flew onto his shaggy hair, singeing it away in patches, until he looked as if a flock of birds had plucked him to make their nests.
"Life's a forge,"
cried the smith, as Taran, his brow streaming, beat at the strip of metal.
"Yes, and hammer and anvil, too. You'll be roasted, smelted, and pounded, and you'll scarce know what's happening to you. But stand boldly to it. Metal's worthless till it's shaped and tempered."
Despite the weariness that made him drop gratefully at day's end to the straw pallet in the shed, Taran's heart quickened, and his spirits rose as the blade, little by little, took shape on the anvil. The heavy hammer seemed to weigh more each time he lifted it. But at last, with a joyous cry, he flung it down and raised the finished sword, well wrought and balanced, gleaming brightly in the light of the forge. "A handsome weapon, Master Smith," he cried, "as fair as the one I bore."
"What then?" Hevid exclaimed. "Have you done your work so well? Would you trust your life to a blade untried?"
He flung out a burly arm toward a wooden block in the corner of the forge.
"Strike hard,"
he commanded.
"The flat, the edge, and the point."
Proudly Taran raised the sword high and swung it down to the block. The weapon shuddered with the force of the blow. A sharp crack and clang smote his ears as the blade shattered and the shards went flying in all directions. Taran shouted in dismay and could have wept as he stared, disbelieving, at the broken hilt still clutched in his hand. He turned and gave Hevid a despairing glance.
"So-ho!"
cried the smith, not at all distressed by Taran's wretched and rueful expression.
"Did you think to gain a worthy blade at first go?"
He laughed loudly and shook his head. "Then what must I do?" Taran cried, appalled at Hevid's words.
"Do?"
the smith retorted.
"What else but start anew?"
And so they did, but this time for Taran there remained little of his joyous hopes. He labored grimly and doggedly, all the more dejected when Hevid ordered him to cast aside two new blades, even before they were tempered, judging them already flawed. The reek of hot metal clung in his nostrils and flavored even the food he hastily swallowed. The billows of steam from the great quenching tub choked him as if he were breathing clouds of scalding fog. The ceaseless din almost addled his wits, until indeed he felt it was himself, not the blade, being hammered. The next blade he shaped seemed to him ugly, dinted and scarred, without the fair proportions of the first, and this too he would have cast aside, had not the smith ordered him to finish it.
"This may well serve,"
Hevid told him confidently, despite the doubtful look Taran gave him. Again Taran strode to the block and raised the sword. Doing his best to shatter the ungraceful weapon, he brought it down with all his strength. The blade rang like a bell. This time it was the block that split in two.
"Now," said Hevid quietly, "that's a blade worth bearing."
Then he clapped his hands and seized Taran's arm.
"You've strength in those chicken wings, after all. You've proved yourself, as well as you proved the blade. Stay, lad, and I'll teach you all I know."
Taran said nothing for a time, but looked, not without pride, at the new forged blade. "You have already taught me much," he said at last to Hevid, "though I lost what I had hoped to gain, for I had hoped I was indeed a swordsmith. I have learned that I am not."
"How then?"
cried Hevid.
"You've the makings of an honest swordsmith, as good as any in Prydain.
It cheers me to think that may be true, Taran answered, but I know in my heart your craft is not mine. A spur drove me from small Averin, and it drives me now, and so must I journey, even if I wish to stay. The smith nodded.
You are well named, wanderer. So be it. I ask no man to go against his heart. Keep the blade in token of friendship. Yours it is, more so than any other, for you forged it with your own hands.
It's not a noble weapon, and thus it suits me all the more, Taran laughed, glancing at the ungainly sword. Lucky it was that I didn't have to make a dozen before it.
Luck?
Snorted Hevid, as Taran and Gurgi took leave of him.
Not so. More labor than luck. Life's a forge, say I. Face the pounding, don't fear the proving, and you'll stand well against any hammer and anvil.
With Hevid the smith waving a sooty hand in farewell, the companions travelled on, bearing northward along the rich valley of Great Averin. A few days of easy riding through pleasant countryside brought them to the edge of Comet Gwenith. Here, a shower suddenly began pelting down on them, and the wayfarers galloped for the first shelter they could find. It was a cluster of sheds, stables, chicken roosts, and storehouses, seeming to ramble in all directions. But as Taran dismounted and hastened to the cottage amid the maze of buildings, he realized all were linked by covered walkways or flagstoned paths, and whichever he followed would sooner or later have brought him to the doorway that opened almost before he knocked on it.
"Come in, and a good greeting to you,"
called a voice crackling like twigs in a fire. As Gurgi scuttled inside to escape the teeming rain, Taran saw a bent old woman cloaked in grey beckoning him to the hearth. Her long hair was white as the wool on the distaff hanging from her belt of plaited cords. Below her short-girt robe, her bony shins looked thin and hard as spindles. A web of wrinkles covered her face. Her cheeks were withered, but for all her years she gave no signs of frailty, as though time had only toughened and seasoned her. And her grey eyes were sharp and bright as a pair of new needles.
"I am Dwivak, weaver woman,"
she replied, as Taran bowed courteously and told her his name.
"Taran Wanderer,"
she repeated with a tart smile.
"From the look of you, I'd say you've indeed been wandering, more than you've been washing. And that's clear as the warp and weft on my loom."
"Yes, yes," cried Gurgi. "See loom of weavings, see windings and bindings. So many, it makes Gurgi's poor tender head swim with twirlings and whirlings."
Taran, for the first time, noticed a high loom, standing like a giant harp of a thousand strings in a corner of the cottage. Around it were stacked bobbins of thread of all colours. From the rafters dangled skeins of yarn, hanks of wool and flax. On the walls hung lengths of finished fabrics, some of bright hue and simple design, others of subtler craftsmanship, and patterns more difficult to follow. Taran gazed, astonished at the endless variety, then turned to the weaver woman of Gwenith. "This calls for skills beyond anything I know," he said admiringly. "How is such work done?"
"How done?"
the weaver woman chuckled.
"It would take me more breath to tell than you have ears to listen. But if you look, you shall see."
So saying, she hobbled to the loom, climbed to the bench in front of it, and with surprising vigour began plying the shuttle back and forth, all the while working her feet on the treadles below, hardly pausing to glance at her handiwork. At last she stopped, cocked her head at Taran, fixed him with her sharp grey eyes, and said,
"Thus is it done, wanderer, as all things are, each in its own way, thread by thread."
Taran's amazement had grown all the more. "This would I gladly learn," he said eagerly. "The craft of the swordsmith was not mine. Perhaps the craft of the weaver may be. I pray you, will you teach it to me?"
"That I will, since you ask," replied Dwivak. "But mind you, it is one thing to admire a well-woven bit of cloth, and another to sit yourself before the loom."
"My thanks to you," Taran exclaimed. "I'll not fear to labour at your loom. With Hevid the smith, I didn't shrink from hot iron or the flames of his forge, and a weaver's shuttle is a lighter burden than a smith's hammer."
"Think you so?"
Dwivak asked, with a dry chuckle that sounded like knitting needles clicking together.
"'Then what shall you weave to begin with?'
she went on, eyeing him sharply.
"'Tar and Wanderer, you call yourself. "'Tar and Threadbare would be more like it. "'Would you weave yourself a new cloak? "'Thus you'll gain something to put on your back, "'and I'll see what skill you have in your fingers.'
"'Taran willingly agreed. "'But next day, instead of teaching him weaving, "'Dwivak led the companions to one of her many chambers.' Which Taran saw nearly full to bursting with piles of wool.
"'Tease out the thorns, pick out the cockle-burrs,'
the weaver woman ordered.
"'Comb it, card it, carefully, wanderer, or when your cloak is done, you'll feel it's made of thistles instead of wool.'
The size of the task ahead of him made Taran despair of ever finishing, but he and Gurgi started the painstaking work, with Dwivak herself lending a hand. The aged weaver woman, Taran soon learned, had not only a tart tongue, but a keen eye. Nothing escaped her. She spied the smallest knot, speck, or flaw, and brought Taran's attention to it with a sharp rap from her distaff to his knuckles. But what smarted Taran more than the distaff was to learn that Dwivak, despite her years, could work faster, longer, and harder than he himself. At the end of each day, Taran's eyes were bleary, his fingers raw, and his head nodded wearily. Yet the old weaver woman was bright and spry, as if the day had scarce begun. Nevertheless, the work at last was finished. But now Dwivak sat him in front of a huge spinning wheel.
"'The finest wool is useless until it's spun to thread,'
the weaver woman told him.
"'So you'd best begin learning that as well.'
"'But spinnings are woman's toilings,'
Gurgi protested.
"'No, no. Spinnings are not fitting for bold and clever weaver men.'
"'Indeed,'
snorted Dwivak.
"'Then sit you down and learn otherwise. I've heard men complain of doing woman's work, and women complain of doing man's work,'
she added, fastening her bony thumb and forefinger on Gurgi's ear and marching him to a stool beside Taran.
"'But I've never heard the work complain of who did it, so long as it got done.'
And so, under Dwivak's watchful eye, Taran and Gurgi spun thread and filled bobbins during the next few days. Chastened by Dwivak's words, Gurgi did his best to help, though all too often the hapless creature managed only to tangle himself in the long strands. Next, Dwivak took the companions to a shed where pots of dye bubbled over a fire. Here, Taran fared no better than Gurgi, for when the yarn was at last dyed, he was bespattered from head to toe with colours, and Gurgi himself looked like a rainbow suddenly sprouting hair. Not until all these other tasks were done to Dwivak's satisfaction did she take Taran to a weaving room, and there his heart sank, for the loom stood bare and stark as a leafless tree.
"'How then?'
clucked the weaver woman as Taran gave her a rueful glance.
"'The loom must be threaded. Did I not tell you? All things are done step by step and strand by strand.'
"'Hevid the smith told me life was a forge,' Taran sighed as he laboriously tried to reckon the countless threads needed. "'And I think I'll be well-tempered before my cloak is finished.'
"'Life a forge?' said the weaver woman. "'A loom, rather, where lives and days intertwine, and wise he is who can learn to see the pattern. But if you mean to have a new cloak, you'd do better to work more and chatter less.' Or did you hope for a host of spiders to come and labour for you?
Even after deciding on the pattern and threading the loom, Taran still saw only a hopeless, confusing tangle of threads. The cloth was painfully slow in forming, and at the end of a long day he had little more than a hand's breadth of fabric to show for all his toil. Did I ever think a weaver shuttle a light burden? Taran sighed. It feels heavier than hammer, tongs, and anvil all together.
"'It's not the shuttle that burdens you,' answered Dwivak, "'but lack of skill, a heavy burden, wanderer, that only one thing can lift.'
"'What secret is that?' Taran cried. "'Teach it to me now, or my cloak will never be done.' But Dwivak only smiled.
"'It is patience, wanderer. As for teaching it, that I cannot do. It is both the first thing and the last thing you must learn for yourself.'
Taran gloomily went back to work, sure he would be as ancient as Dwivak before finishing the garment. Nevertheless, As his hands became used to the task, the shuttle darted back and forth like a fish among reeds, and the cloth grew steadily on the loom. Though Dwivak was satisfied with his progress, Taran, to his own surprise, was not. "The pattern," he murmured, frowning. "I don't know. Somehow it doesn't please me."
"Now then, wanderer," replied Dwivak. "No man put a sword to your throat. The choice of pattern was your own."
"That it was," Taran admitted. "But now I see it closely, I would rather have chosen another."
"Ah," said Dwivak with her dry chuckle. "In that case, you have but one of two things to do. Either finish a cloak you'll be ill content to wear, or unravel it and start anew. For the loom weaves only the pattern set upon it."
Taran stared a long while at his handiwork. At last he took a deep breath, sighed, and shook his head. "So be it. I'll start anew." Over the next few days he ruefully unthreaded and rethreaded the loom, but after it was ready and he began weaving once again, he was delighted to find the cloth grow faster than ever it had done before, and his spirit rose with his newfound skill. When the cloak at last was done, he held it up proudly. "This is far better than what I had," he cried, "but I doubt I'll ever be able to wear a cloak again without thinking of every thread." Gergi shouted triumphantly, and Dwivak bobbed her head in approval.
"Well woven," she said.
Her expression had lost much of its tartness, and she looked fondly at Taran, seeming to smile within herself.
"You have skill in your fingers, wanderer," she said, with unaccustomed gentleness. "Enough to make you one of the finest weavers in Prydain. And if my distaff and your knuckles met more often than you liked, it was because I deemed you worth reproving. Dwell in my house if you choose, work at my loom, and what I know I will teach you."
Taran did not answer immediately, and, as he hesitated, the weaver woman smiled and spoke again.
"I know what is in your heart, wanderer," she said. "A young man's way is restless. Yes, and a young girl's too. I'm not so gone in years that I've forgotten. Your face tells me it is not your wish to stay in Comet Gwynedd."
Taran nodded. "As much as I hope to be a swordsmith, so I hope to be a weaver. But you speak truth. This is not the way I would follow."
"Then we must say farewell," answered the weaver woman. "But mind you," she added, in her usual sharp tone, "if life is a loom, the pattern you weave is not so easily unravelled."
Taran and Gergi set off again, still journeying northward, and soon Comet Gwynedd was far behind them. Though Taran wore his new cloak on his shoulders and his new blade at his side, his pleasure in them shortly gave way to disquiet. The words of Dwivak lingered in his mind, and his thoughts turned to another loom in the distant marshes of Morva. "And what of Ordu?" he said. "Does she weave with more than threads? The robin has truly been scratching for his worms. But have I indeed chosen my own pattern, or am I no more than a thread on her loom? If that be so, then I fear it's a thread serving little purpose. At any rate," he added with a rueful laugh, "it's a long and tangled one." But these gloomy thoughts flew from his mind when, some days later, Melinlas bore him to the top of a rise, and he looked down on the fairest comet he had ever seen. A tall stand of firs and hemlocks circled broad, well-tended fields, green and abundant. White thatch-roofed cottages sparkled in shafts of sunlight. The air itself seemed different to him, cool and touched with the sharp scent of evergreens. His heart quickened as he watched, and a strange excitement filled him. Gergi had ridden up beside him.
"Kindly master, can we not stop here?"
"Yes," Taran murmured, his eyes never leaving the fields and cottages. "Yes, here shall we rest." He urged Melinlas down the slope, with Gergi cantering eagerly behind him. Crossing a shallow stream, Taran reined up at the sight of a hale old man digging busily near the water's edge. Beside him stood a pair of wooden buckets on a yoke, and into these he carefully poured spadefuls of pale brown earth. His iron grey hair and beard were cropped short. Despite his age, His arms seemed as brawny as those of Hevid the smith. "A good greeting to you, Master Delver," Taran called. "What place is this?" The man turned, wiped his deeply lined brow with a forearm, and looked at Taran with keen blue eyes.
"The water your horse is standing in, and churning to mud, by the way, is Fernbrake Stream. The Comet. This is Comet Merin."
Chapter 19. The Potter's Wheel.
"I've told you where you are," the man went on good-naturedly, as Taran dismounted at the bank of the stream. "Now might you be willing to tell me who you are, and what brings you to a place whose name you must ask? Have you lost your way, and found Merin when you sought another comet?"
"I am called Wanderer," Taran replied.
"As for losing my way," he added with a laugh, "I can't say that I have, for I'm not sure myself where my path lies." "Then Merin is as fair a place as any to break your journey," the man said. "Come along, if you'd see what hospitality I can offer the two of you."
As the man dropped a last spadeful of clay into the wooden buckets, Taran stepped forward and offered to carry them, and since the man did not refuse, set his shoulders under the yoke. But the buckets were heavier than Taran reckoned. His brow soon burst out in sweat. He could barely stagger along under the load he felt doubling at every pace. And the hut to which the man pointed seemed to grow farther instead of closer.
"If you seek Daub to mend your chimney," Taran gasped, "you've come a long way to find it." "You've not caught the trick of that yoke," said the man, grinning broadly at Taran's effort.
He shouldered the buckets, which Taran gladly gave back, and strode along so briskly, despite the weight of his burden, that he nearly outdistanced the companions. Arriving at a long shed, he poured the clay into a great wooden vat, then beckoned the wayfarers to enter his hut. Inside, Taran saw racks and shelves, holding earthenware of all kinds, vessels of plain-baked clay, graceful jars, and among these, at random, pieces whose craftsmanship and beauty made him catch his breath. Only once, in the treasure house of Lord Gast, had he set eyes on handiwork such as this. He turned, astonished, to the old man, who had begun laying dishes and bowls on an oaken table. "When I asked if you sought Daub to mend your chimney, I spoke foolishly," Taran said, humbly bowing. "If this is your work, I have seen some of it before, and I know you. Anlaw, clay shaper." The potter nodded.
"My work it is. If you've seen it, it may be that indeed you do know me, for I am old at my craft, Wanderer, and no longer sure where the clay ends and Anlaw begins, or in truth, if they're not one and the same."
Taran looked closer at the vessels crowding the hut, at the newly finished wine bowl shaped even more skillfully than the one in Lord Gast's trove, at the long, clay-spattered tables covered with jars of paints, pigments, and glazes. Now he saw in wonder that what he had first taken for common scullery ware was as beautiful in its own way as the wine bowl. All had come from a master's hand. He turned to Anlaw. "It was told me," Taran said, "that one piece of your making is worth more than all of a Cantrev lord's treasure house, and I well believe it. And here," he shook his head in amazement, "this is a treasure house in itself."
"Yes, yes," Gurgi cried. "Oh, skillful potter gains riches and fortune from clever shapings."
"Riches and fortune?" replied Anlaw, smiling. "Food for my table, rather. Most of these pots and bowls I send to the small comets, where the folk have no potter of their own. As I give what they need, they give what I need, and treasure is what I need the least. My joy is in the craft, not the gain. Would all the fortunes in Prydain help my fingers shape a better bowl?"
"There are those," Taran said, half in earnest as he glanced at the potter's wheel, "who claim work such as yours comes by enchantment." At this, Anlaw threw back his head and laughed heartily.
"I wish it did, for it would spare much toil. No, no, Wanderer, my wheel, alas, is like any other. True it is," he added, "that Govanian the Lame, master craftsman of Prydain, long ago fashioned all manner of enchanted implements. He gave them to whom he deemed would use them wisely and well,
but one by one they fell into the clutches of a Rorn Death Lord. Now all are gone. But Govanian, too, discovered and set down the high secrets of all crafts, Anlor went on. These as well, Aron stole, to hoard in Anuvin, where none may ever profit from them.
The potter's face turned grave.
A lifetime have I striven to discover them again, to guess what might have been their nature. Much have I learned by doing, as a child learns to walk. But my steps falter. The deepest lore yet lies beyond my grasp. I fear it ever shall. Let me gain this lore, Anlor said, and I'll yearn for no magical tools. Let me find the knowledge. And these, he added, holding up his clay-crusted hands, these will be enough to serve me.
But you know what you seek, Taran answered. I, alas, seek without knowing even where to look. He then told Anlor of Hevid the smith and Dwivak the weaver woman, of the sword and cloak he had made. I was proud of my work, Taran went on. Yet, at the end, neither anvil nor loom satisfied me.
What of the potter's wheel? Asked Anlor.
When Taran admitted he knew nothing of this craft, and prayed Anlor to let him see the shaping of clay, the old potter willingly agreed. Anlor drew up his coarse robe and seated himself at the wheel, which he quickly set spinning, and on it flung a lump of clay. The potter bent almost humbly to his work, and reached out his hands as tenderly as if he were lifting an unfledged bird. Before Taran's eyes, Anlor began shaping a tall, slender vessel. As Taran stared in awe, the clay seemed to shimmer on the swiftly turning wheel and to change from moment to moment. Now Taran understood Anlor's words, for indeed, between the potter's deft fingers and the clay he saw no separation, as though Anlor's hands flowed into the clay and gave it life. Anlor was silent and intent. His lined face had brightened. The years had fallen away from it. Taran felt his heart fill with a joy that seemed to reach from the potter to himself, and in that moment understood that he was in the presence of a true master craftsman, greater than any he had ever known.
"Fluda was wrong," Taran murmured. "If there is enchantment, it lies not in the potter's wheel, but in the potter."
"Enchantment there is none," answered Anlor, never turning from his work. "A gift, perhaps, but a gift that bears with it much toil."
"If I could make a thing of such beauty, it is toil I would welcome," Taran said.
"Sit you down, then," said Anlor, making room for Taran at the wheel. "Shape the clay for yourself."
When Taran protested he would spoil Anlor's half-formed vessel, the potter only laughed.
"Spoil it you will, surely. I'll toss it back into the kneading trough, mix it with the other clay, and sooner or later it will serve again. It will not be lost. Indeed, nothing ever is, but comes back in one shape or another."
"But for yourself," Taran said, "the skill you have already put in it will be wasted." The potter shook his head.
"Not so. Craftsmanship isn't like water in an earthen pot, to be taken out by the dipper full until it's empty. No, the more drawn out, the more remains. The heart renews itself, wanderer, and skill grows all the better for it. Here, then, your hands thus, your thumbs thus."
From the first moment Taran felt the clay whirling beneath his fingers, his heart leapt with the same joy he had seen on the potter's face. The pride of forging his own sword and weaving his own cloak dwindled before this new discovery that made him cry out in sudden delight. But his hands faltered, and the clay went awry. Anlor stopped the wheel. Taran's first vessel was so lopsided and misshapen that, despite his disappointment, he threw back his head and laughed. Anlor clapped him on the shoulder.
"Well tried, wanderer. The first bowl I turned was as ill-favoured. And worse. You have the touch for it, but before you learn the craft, you must first learn the clay. Dig, sift, and knead it, know its nature better than that of your closest companion. Then grind pigments for your glazes, understand how the fire of the kiln works upon them."
"Anlor, clay shaper," Taran said in a low voice that hid nothing of his yearning, "will you teach me your craft? This more than all else I long to do." Anlor hesitated several moments and looked deeply at Taran.
I can teach you only what you can learn, said the potter. How much that may be, time will tell. Stay, if that is your wish. Tomorrow we shall begin.
The two wayfarers made themselves comfortable that night in a snug corner of the pottery shed. Gergi curled on the straw pallet, but Taran sat with knees drawn up and arms clasped about them. It's strange, he murmured. The more of the Comet folk I've known, the fonder have I grown of them. Yet Comet Merrin drew me at first sight, closer than all the others. The night was soft and still. Taran smiled wistfully in the darkness. The moment I saw it, I thought it the one place I'd be content to dwell, and that even Ailanwi might have been happy here. And at Anlor's wheel, he went on, when my hands touched the clay, I knew I would count myself happy to be a potter. More than smithing, more than weaving, it's as though I could speak through my fingers, as though I could give shape to what was in my heart. I understand what Anlor meant. There is no difference between him and his work. Indeed, Anlor puts himself into the clay and makes it live with his own life. If I, too, might learn to do this... Gergi did not answer. The weary creature was fast asleep. Taran smiled and drew the cloak over Gergi's shoulders. Sleep well, he said. We may have come to the end of our journey. Anlor was as good as his word. In the days that followed, the potter showed Taran skills no less important than the working of the clay itself. The finding of proper earths, judging their texture and quality, sifting, mixing, tempering. Gergi joined Taran in all the tasks, and soon his shaggy hair grew so crusted with dust, mud, and gritty glaze that he looked like an unbaked clay pot set on a pair of skinny legs. The summer sped quickly and happily, and the more Taran saw the potter at his craft, the more he marvelled. At the kneading trough, Anlor pounded the clay with greater vigour than heavied the smith at his anvil, and at the wheel did the most intricate work with a deftness surpassing even that of Dwivak the weaver woman. As early as he rose in the mornings, Taran always found the potter already up and about his tasks. Anlor was tireless, often spending nights without sleep and days without food, absorbed in labour at his wheel. Seldom was the potter content to repeat a pattern, but strove to better even what he himself had originated.
"Stale water is a poor drink," said Anlor. "Stale skill is worse. And the man who walks in his own footsteps only ends where he began."
Not until autumn did Anlor let Taran try his hand at the wheel again. This time, the bowl Taran shaped was not as ill-formed as the other. Anlor, studying it carefully, nodded his head and told him,
"You have learned a little, wanderer."
Nevertheless, to Taran's dismay, Anlor cast the bowl into the kneading trough.
"Never fear," said the potter. "When you shape one worth the keeping, it will be fired in the kiln."
Though Taran feared such a time might never come, it was not long before Anlor judged a vessel, a shallow bowl, simple in design, yet well proportioned, to be ready for firing. He set it, along with other pots and bowls he had crafted for the folk of Comet Isav, into a kiln taller and deeper than Hevid's furnace. While Anlor calmly turned to finishing other vessels for the Comet folk, Taran's anxiety grew until he felt that he himself was baking in the flames. But at last, when the firing was done and the pieces had cooled, the potter drew out the bowl, turned it around in his hands as Taran waited breathlessly, and tapped it with a clay-rimmed finger. He grinned at Taran.
"It rings true. Beginner's work, wanderer, but not to be ashamed of."
Taran's heart lifted as if he had fashioned a wine bowl handsomer than ever Lord Ghast had seen. But his joy changed soon to despair. Through autumn, Taran shaped other vessels, yet, to his growing dismay, none satisfied him, none matched his hopes, despite the painful toil he poured into the work.
"What lacks?" he cried to Anlor. "I could forge a sword well enough and weave a cloak well enough, but now what I truly long to grasp is beyond my reach. Must the one skill I sought above all be denied me?"
he burst out in an anguished voice.
"Is the gift forbidden me?"
He bowed his head, and his heart froze even as he spoke the words, for he knew, within himself, he had touched the truth. Anlor did not gainsay him, but only looked at him for a long while with deep sadness.
"Why?"
Taran whispered. Why is this so?
It is a heavy question,
Anlor replied at last. He put a hand on Taran's shoulder.
Indeed, no man can answer it. There are those who have labored all their lives to gain the gift, striving until the end only to find themselves mistaken. And those who had it born in them yet never knew. Those who lost heart too soon, and those who should never have begun at all. Count yourself lucky, the potter went on, that you have understood this now, and not spent your years in vain hope. This much have you learned, and no learning is wasted.
What then shall I do? Taran asked. Grief and bitterness such as he had known in Craddock's valley flooded over him.
There are more ways to happiness than in the shaping of a pot, replied Anlor. You have been happy in Merin. You still can be. There is work for you to do. Your help is welcome and valuable to me, as a friend as much as an apprentice. Why, look you now, he went on in a cheerful tone. Tomorrow I would send my ware to Comat Isav. But a day's journey is long for one of my years. As a friend, will you bear the burden for me?
Taran nodded.
I will carry your ware to Isav.
He turned away, knowing that his happiness was ended, like a flawed vessel shattered in the firing. Chapter 20 The Spoilers. Next morning, as Taran had promised, he loaded Melinlas and Gergi's pony with the potter's ware, and, Gergi beside him, set out for Comat Isav. Anlor, he knew, could as well have sent word to the Comat folk, asking them to come and bear away their own vessels.
This is not an errand I do for him, but a kindness he does for me, Taran told Gergi. I think he means to give me time to myself, to find my own thoughts. As for that, he added sorrowfully, so far I've found none. I long to stay in Merin, yet there's little to keep me here. I prize Anlor as my friend and as a master of his craft, but his craft will never be mine.
Still pondering and troubled at heart, Taran reached Isav some while before dusk. It was the smallest comet of all he had seen, with fewer than half a dozen cottages and a little grazing plot for a handful of sheep and cattle. A knot of men were gathered by the sheepfold. As Taran rode closer, he saw their faces tightly drawn and grim. Perplexed at this, he called out his name and told them he brought pottery from Anlor Clayshaper.
"Greetings to you," said one man, naming himself as Drudwas, son of Pebir. "And farewell in the same breath," he added. "Our thanks to Anlor and yourself, but stay to share our hospitality, and you may stay to shed your blood." "Outlaws rove the hills,"
Drudwas went on quickly, answering Taran's questioning frown.
"A band, perhaps a dozen strong. We have heard they plundered two comets already, and not content were they with a sheep or cow for their own food, but slaughtered all the herd for the joy of it. Today, not long past, I saw horsemen over the rise, and leading them a yellow-haired ruffian on a sorrel mare."
"Dorath," Taran cried.
"How then?"
asked one of the comet men.
"Do you know this band?"
"If it's Dorath's company, I know them well enough," Taran answered. "They are paid swords, and if none will hire them, I judge them glad to kill, even without fee. Hard warriors they are, as I have seen them, and cruel as the huntsmen of Anuvin." Drudwas nodded gravely.
"So it is said. It may be they will pass us by," he went on, "but this I doubt. Comat Isav is small prey, but where defenders are few, the reasons to attack are all the more."
Taran glanced at the men. From their faces and bearing, he knew their courage would not lack. But once more he heard Dorath's laughter, and recalled the man's cunning and ruthlessness. "And if they attack," he asked, "what shall you do?"
"What would you have us do?"
Drudwas angrily burst out.
"Offer tribute and beg them to spare us? Give our animals to their swords and our homes to their torches? Comat Isav has ever been at peace. Our pride is husbandry, not warfare. But we mean to stand against them. Have we better choice?"
"I can ride back to Merin," Taran replied, "and bring you help."
"Too far and too long," Drudwas answered. "Nor would I do so even then, for it would leave Merin ill-defended. No, we stand as we are. Against 12, 7. My son Lassa
he began, indicating a tall, eager-faced boy, scarcely older than Taran had been when Carl first dubbed him assistant pig-keeper. "Your count is amiss," Taran interrupted. "You are not 7, but 9. Gergi and I stand with you." Drudwas shook his head.
"You owe us no service or duty, Wanderer. We welcome your swords, but will not ask for them."
"They are yours, nonetheless," Taran replied, and Gergi nodded agreement. "Will you heed me? 9 may stand against 12 and win the day, but with Dorath, number counts less than skill. Were he alone, I would still fear him as much as 12. He will fight shrewdly and strive to gain the most at least cost. We must answer him in kind." The combat men listened carefully as Taran then spoke of a ruse to make the raiders believe themselves outnumbered, and to attack where Dorath would expect no more than feeble defense. "If 2 men were to lie waiting in the sheepfold, and 2 in the cattle pen, ready to spring up," Taran said, "they might take the band unawares, and hold them a few moments, while the rest of us attack from ambush in the rear. At the same time, if the women of your household set up a din with rakes and hoes, it would seem other swordsmen had hastened to join us." Drudwas thought a long moment, then nodded.
"Your plan may be sound, Wanderer, but I fear for those in the pens, as they must bear the brunt for all of us. If aught should go awry, small chance of escape would they have."
"I shall be one to keep watching the sheepfold," Taran began.
"And I the other?"
Lassa broke in quickly. Drudwas frowned.
"I would not spare you because you are my son. You are a good lad and gentle with the flock. I think of your years."
"The flock is in my charge," Lassa cried. "By right, my place is with the Wanderer."
The men spoke hurriedly among themselves, at last agreeing that Lassa would keep watch with Taran, while Drudwas stood guard over the cattle along with Gergi, who, fearful though he was, refused to be any farther from Taran's side. By the time all plans were set and the combat men posted among the trees just beyond the sheepfold, a full moon had risen above thin clouds. The cold light sharpened the edges of the shadows and the outlines of brush and branches. In the fold, Taran and Lassa crouched amid the restless flock. For a time, neither spoke. In the bright moonlight, the face of Lassa seemed to Taran more boyish than before. He saw the youth was afraid and making all effort to hide it. Though uneasy himself, he grinned assuringly at Lassa. Drudwas had been right. The boy was young, untried, and yet, Taran smiled, knowing that he himself, at Lassa's age, would have claimed the same right.
"Your plan is good, Wanderer,"
Lassa said at last in a hushed voice, speaking, Taran knew, more to ease his own disquiet than anything else.
"Better than we should have done. It cannot fail."
"All plans can fail," Taran said, almost harshly. He fell silent then. Fears had begun stirring in him like leaves in a chill wind. Sweat drenched his body under the fleece jacket. He had come to Isav unknown, unproven, yet the men of the comet had willingly heeded him and willingly put their fate in his hands. They had accepted his plan when another might have served better. Should it fail, though all their lives could be forfeit, the blame would be his alone. He gripped the hilt of his sword and strained his eyes to peer into the darkness. There was no movement, and even the shadows seemed frozen.
"You are called Wanderer,"
Lassa went on quietly, with some shyness.
"To my mind, one who wanders must as well be one who seeks. Is this true?"
Taran shook his head. "I sought once to be a smith, and once to be a weaver, and once a potter. But that is over. Now perhaps I must wander without seeking."
"If you seek nothing," Lassa said with a friendly laugh, "then you have little chance of finding it." "Our life is not easy here," he went on. "It is not willingness that lacks, but knowledge. The sons of Don have long held Prydain against the Lord of Anuvin, and for their protection we are grateful. Yet the secrets Aron Deathlord stole from us, to regain them, my father says, would give us stouter shield and sword than even the battle hosts of Prince Gwydion himself. But for all that, Isav is my home, and I am well content in it."
Lassa grinned.
"I do not envy you, Wanderer."
Taran did not answer for a time. Then he murmured, "No, it is I who envy you." They said no more, listening alertly to every sound as the night wore away, and the moon, fading behind thickening clouds, lost shape, and its light spread like pale mist. In a while, Lasse blew out his breath in relief.
"They will not come," he said. "They will pass us by."
Even as he spoke, the darkness shattered in fragments that turned into the figures of armed warriors. Taran sprang to his feet as the gate burst open. Taran sounded his battle horn, then flung himself upon the warrior, who cried out in surprise and stumbled backward. Lasse had leapt up at the same instant as Taran, and the shepherd plunged against the press of the attackers at the gate, thrusting with his spear. Taran struck out blindly, struggling not only against the raiders, but against the sudden terror that his plan had failed, that the outlaws had come too silently, too swiftly. In another moment, above the frantic bleating of the frightened animals, a great shout burst from the comet men as they rose from the cover of the trees, and from the huts came the clash of iron upon iron. At the sheepfold, the outlaws hesitated. Lasse's opponent had fallen. Taran glimpsed the boy spring past him and strike again with his spear. The attack wavered at the gate as the raiders turned their weapons against the men of Isav. But one warrior, growling like a wild beast, long knife upraised, raced into the pen as if to wreak all the destruction he could, and Taran grappled with the man who spun about and slashed at him. It was Glof. The warrior recognized him. Glof's first astonishment changed to an ugly grin almost of pleasure and eagerness as he shifted the knife in his hand. Glof lunged, and Taran flung up his weapon to ward against the blow. But the warrior leapt forward, his free hand clawing at Taran's eyes, and his blade flickered as its point drove swiftly in a killing stroke. A figure plunged between them. It was Lasse. Taran shouted a warning as the boy strove to catch the blow on his spear shaft. Snarling, Glof turned his attack and struck viciously at Lasse. The shepherd fell. With a cry of rage, Taran raised his sword. Suddenly, Drudwas was beside him. Glof shrieked as the blade of the husbandman chopped downward. Under the onslaught of the comet folk, Dorath's warriors fell back. Amid the turmoil of racing men, Taran found himself borne away from the fold. Daring a backward glance, he could glimpse neither Drudwas nor Lasse. In fury, he pressed onward. Torches flared, and he saw that the women and girls of Isav had joined their men, flailing with hoes, rakes, and pitchforks at the raiders. Taran cast about for Gurgi and shouted his name, but his voice was drowned in the tumult. A fierce bellowing had risen from the cattle pen as a dark shape burst through the bars. Taran gasped in astonishment to see a furious black bull heaving and plunging among the raiders. On its back clung Gurgi, yelling at the top of his voice, kicking his heels against the powerful animal's flanks, turning its charge against the terrified remainder of Dorath's band.
"They flee!" shouted one of the comet men.
Taran pressed ahead. The raiders, who had left their mounts at the fringe of trees, now hastened to gain them, caught between the comet folk and the slashing horns of the enraged bull. Taran glimpsed Dorath astride the sorrel mare and ran to overtake him, but Dorath spurred the steed and galloped into the wood. Taran turned and raced to the stables, whistling for Melinlas. One of the comet men caught at his arm and cried,
"The day is ours, wanderer."
Only then did Taran realize the sounds of the fray had ceased. Dorath himself had vanished. Taran hurried to the sheephold, where the wife of Drudwas knelt, her arms about her son.
"Lasse!"
Taran cried in dismay, dropping beside the shepherd. The boy's eyes opened and he strove to grin at Taran.
"His wound is not deep," said Drudwas. "He will live to tend his flock."
"And so I will," Lasse said to Taran, "and thanks to you, I'll have a flock to tend."
Taran put a hand on the boy's shoulder. "And to you," he answered, "to you I owe much more than sheep."
"Full half the band will plunder no longer," said Drudwas. "Neither comet Isav nor any comet. The rest are scattered, and it will be long before their wounds heal. You have well served us, wanderer, you and your companion. You came among us strangers. We count you strangers no longer, but friends."
Chapter 21. The Mirror. Although the folk of Isav urged him to linger, Taran took leave of them and rode slowly back to Merin. The defeat of Dorath's company held no savor, for his thoughts still turned restlessly. His questions still found no answers, and he was more downhearted than ever. To Anlor he said little of his deeds in Isav, and it was Gurgi, bursting with pride, who told what had befallen them.
Yes, yes, cried Gergi. Wicked robbers fled with yellings. Oh, they feared kindly master, and feared bold Gergi too, and great bull with stampings and trampings, sharp horns with jabbings and stabbings.